For great-looking t-shirts, hoodies, and sweatshirts, the TNT shop is now open at tntradio.live. Using science to debunk myths, from the pandemic to climate fraud. Thanks for listening to Sky Dragon Slaying on TNT Radio.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of Sky Dragon Slaying, where we bring you the truth on science and current affairs, the mainstream we'd rather you didn't know. I'm John O'Sullivan, CEO of Principia Scientific International. Joining me as usual is text engineer extraordinaire, Joe Olson. On today's show, we'll be focusing on the widespread lack of critical reasoning skills, especially seen over the past 2.5 years with the general gullibility shown since the outbreak of COVID-19 pandemic. Helping us in that journey down the rabbit hole is a respected academic, British professor Gloria Moss. Dr. Moss is an expert in education strategy and the author of 6 books, over 30 peer-reviewed journal articles, and has been a keynote speaker at several major international conferences. She appeared on the last show in September, and we are so happy to have her back again. Hi, Gloria. How are you?
Hi, I'm very well. It's great to be back.
Yeah, we're really looking forward to this one. We know you've got your new book out, and that's going to be the main topic to start us off. Your new book is Lightbulb Moments and the Power of Critical Thinking, Insights from Inquiring Minds and Literary Heroes. That's a long title. What's your general theme? I mean, obviously, talking about literary heroes, who are they?
Ah, well, yes. Well, what we're doing in this book, and I say we because I have a co-author, Catherine Armitage, who coordinates in a magnificent way the anti-5G campaign in Britain. What we do is rather exciting. We trace the importance of critical thinking way back to Plato's time and Socrates, of course. And we see how it's dominated intellectual life right up until Einstein. And then even the BBC, would you believe it, talks about the importance of critical thinking. I can go through some of these quotes in a minute, John. But what's rather strange, as you say, is that we seem to find ourselves in a period of history when the absence of critical thinking is perhaps more evident than the presence. And so this is why we wrote the book. And why is there an absence? Well, we can discuss that. There are many, many psychologists who've waded in here and talked about the reasons, the multiple obstacles, psychological. They're very fascinating. So I'd love to have a chance to talk about those today. And it's not just psychological, it's physiological factors as well. So if people are looking at information that's televisually presented to them, be it on a TV or video screen, then that actually has a very physical effect, shutting down critical thinking in very specific ways, which again, I'd love to have the opportunity to talk about. And fear and anxiety, well, there's been a fair amount of that in the last 3 years, that can also shut down critical thinking. And well, we'll see that various political commentators back in the, as far back as the 18th century, said that governments loved fear. They didn't know perhaps the physiological reasons in those days, but they governments loved fear because it stopped people critically thinking. But the one thing that hadn't been discussed is, well, yeah, there are all these factors that shut down critical thinking, but what actually encourages it? So this is where a lot of what's in the book is completely original. And well, we can talk about this, the very important factors that we've discovered actually encourage it. And here is where our literary heroes come in, because we have 24 current writers who've given their critical thinking journeys, and we've looked at the triggers for them. And lo and behold, we found that the triggers that it sparked off their critical thinking journeys, and also the critical thinking journeys of people contributed to an online survey on the Truth University website, that those coalesce, and those triggers are also present in the fictional lives of John Smith in 1984, George Orwell's famous novel, and present also in the hero of Brave New World by Aldous Huxley, and present also in The Hero of Fahrenheit 451. So what we're saying really is that you have to be somebody quite special to think critically, because you need to overcome the multitude of obstacles that stand in your way. And but once you manage to do that, then you share, we think, the heroic status of these remarkable literary heroes.
Yeah, and you know, just to give our listeners a kind of an idea of your background, you've written many books. Your specialties obviously cover history, management, and consumer behavior. And you're a very passionate advocate of evidence-based teaching and research, and very much you know, somebody that we warm to, because you know, Joe Olson and my colleague Joe Olson and I, we at Principia Scientific International for 12 years, we've been banging on about the importance of evidence-based science. In this is something lacking today, isn't it? The idea that empiricism, you know, learning from behavior, learning from evidence, real world evidence rather than a priori dogma, these are things that are at a premium now, and I'm sure you go along with that.
Well, absolutely, and this is why we were determined to get the book out at this point in history, because my goodness, we do need it. And your work with Joe Olson is fantastic in organizing Principia Scientific. So would it be helpful if I just go through some of the sort of foundations for this, do you think? And yeah, and some of the reasons why it's so important. I'm sure we join forces on this to be looking at this.
Yeah, I mean, we're
today.
Very open to giving you a complete platform, a free platform, Gloria. And I'd like you just to try and make it, just give us a summary, a minute or two summary for our general listeners, some of whom are not scientifically trained, general readers who are looking for some insight on this kind of issue.
Well, yes. I mean, Socrates via Plato said that a life without investigation is not worth living. And I think we'd all agree that if you don't look at the evidence, as you've just said, then how can you possibly know whether anything is true or not, and whether you're having the wool pulled over your eyes? There's no way you can. And he wasn't on his own. Descartes, hundreds of years later, and a very interesting quote, he's the "I think, therefore I am" chap, Descartes in France, he said that every part of thinking should be questioned, doubted, and, wait for it, tested. Isn't that relevant to the last few years?
Very much true.
And notice he used the word questioned. Every part of thinking, he said, should be questioned, doubted. You know, it's fine to doubt. Socrates said so. Descartes says so. Sorry, go on, John.
Yeah. I just want to jump in and add the point that what we've noticed, Joe Austin and myself and many, many of our colleagues over the past 2.5 years during the COVID pandemic, is this unquestioning obedience, the following of authority. And I try to talk to young people who've been through the academic system, especially in the UK and the US, where we have a very high proportion university educated people are coming out with degrees, all kinds of degrees and all subjects, and yet they don't seem to grasp that the idea here is to be skeptical. The idea is not to buy into this. And right from the outset of the pandemic, Laura, you and I, we know this, we were told to trust the experts, trust. And that's just a simple appeal to authority, isn't it? Nothing more.
Yeah, well, it is. And it's not what, you know, one of the premier scientists has said to us, Albert Einstein. He said, quite simply, question everything. He didn't say accept everything. He said, question everything. He said, the important thing is not to stop questioning. Never lose a holy curiosity. And it's very interesting he talked about curiosity, because that was one of the top features that was common to our remarkable 24 writers. And I would like to talk about them at some point, because they include people like Mark Devlin, John Hamer, Matthew Ehret, so many. Neil Kramer, Catherine Armitage, my co-author, myself, they all were driven on their questioning journeys by a very strong curiosity. And
yeah, and diverse backgrounds. I should emphasize diverse backgrounds. I mean, your co-author, Catherine Armitage, she's a homeopath, an activist,
yes,
and into spiritual service. You know, this isn't just an intellectual exercise. These are people who you've got, you know, quite a broad view of the world, you know, spiritual aspect too. And this is something that we welcome. It's becoming apparent now that we're going through a time where I'm sensing, and Joe Olson may agree with me, where people are questioning what is the whole purpose of life. You know, are we seeing a resurgence in spirituality, do you think?
Well, there are, and for example, the last contributions from the 24, which is sandwiched in the middle of the book, these 24 remarkable contributions, I think, they've become increasingly philosophical and spiritual. So there's a piece there by Neil Cramer, who was British born but now lives in the US, and he begins by saying that I think you'd be on this on his page as well, John, that saying education is essentially an indoctrination system. Yeah. It shouldn't be, but it often is. And then he goes on to, he's a theologian by background, and he goes on to talk about the role that evil can play in the world. And he says that every one of us is faced with a choice to either take advantage of the systems that come out of the evil, profit from them, or to fight them. It's tremendously powerful, his contribution. And I don't know if you'd go along with that. It very much chimes with my way of thinking. Yeah. And then right at the end of the book, or the penultimate contribution, we have a contribution from somebody in Sweden, Marcus Olofsson, who seems to really be, his reality is much wider than that of many people, because he has out-of-body experiences, for example. His background is as a counsellor and a psychologist, and this is where his journey has taken him. So yes, we have a very broad spectrum of opinion presented, but everybody has moved in the course of their lives through the process of applying critical thinking, and it produces some remarkable conclusions. And we wrote this book because, as you said, a lot of people's thinking is determined by what they're told to think, and they're not being encouraged to ask questions, whether at school level there are correct answers and incorrect answers. I don't know how much curiosity has been fostered at school. I mean, you know, I wrote a report on secondary school textbooks, and it struck me that across the board, you know, whatever the subject, pupils were being expected to learn facts by rote. Yeah. And incidentally, the facts were very often incorrect. So that's very concerning. And so we're at a time here where we do need to take it into our hands now to start a campaign, really, to revive critical thinking. Because as I said, this tradition of critical thinking goes right back to Socrates, through Descartes, through, I didn't mention Jung, the psychologist.
Yeah,
he said
point.
The ability to ask questions is the greatest resource in learning the truth. So there's a long tradition of asking questions. And here we are in a world, as you say, where this practice, you mentioned young people, seems not to be particularly evident.
No, I totally agree with you. And the era of fact checkers is an era to be wary of. Joe Olson, what's your take on this?
Yes. Well, I was just looking up one of my favorite phrases to describe our current false reality. I've been saying for a long time that we live in a false paradigm reality bounded by faux science, fake history, filtered news, fiat and financed by a fiat currency and directed by demonic warlords. And so basically we're in kind of a Potokum village, which is a Russian phrase for any false construct devised to disguise a shortcoming or improve appearances. And let's start with the metaphor on Dr. Moss's book, and that is the light bulb. When was the light bulb invented? They will tell you by Edison in 1879, but if you do a little bit of research, you can find out that one of Isaac Newton's assistants, Francis Hauksbee, H-A-U-K-S-B-E-E, invented electric light in 1705. This was improved by Humphrey Davies, who presented an electric light to the Royal Society in 1801. And then in 1805, he had perfected a carbon arc electric light where they closed all of the windows and blinds in the Royal Society auditorium, and he lit it up brighter than daylight. And so all of that happened prior to Edison. And then we have the other issue that they constantly redefine terms so that you never even know what you're actually discussing. A perfect example of that is the term that they're using now for everything is equity. We're going to make everything equitable and we're going to have equity. Well, the classic definition, I looked it up this week, for equity is money value in excess of liens or claims. But now the new definition is fair and impartial. Mm-hmm. And that's another example of the restructuring of vocabulary to meet a goal is demoralize. And traditionally, the word demoralized meant having lost confidence or hope, disheartened. Well, now you can look at demoralized as being a three-segmented word where moral is the important thing. Demoralize is going to be just like demilitarize or denazify or whatever else it is that they're planning on doing. But in this case, demoralize is going to legitimize what had previously been taboos, which would be start off with gay marriage, then you go polygamy, then pedophilia, then bestiality, then incest, then necrophilia, then cannibalism. And then you have nothing in the way of a social contract that could make a binding successful society. And you don't have to be a Christian to live in a country that benefits by the vast majority of the people subscribing to a basic set of rules, just like the Ten Commandments. But when you have a group of people that do not subscribe to that, then you have no ability of having an effective culture or a society, and you're going to be doomed to a Roman Empire collapse. And that looks like what we're in the final throes of right now. The only hopeful thing is that there's a lot of people that are waking up, and the people that are unjabbed and fully awake are going to be able to help lead the rest of the people on this planet to hopefully a brighter future with fewer plutocrats in charge.
Yeah, fair point, Joe. We're going to take a short break now. This is TNT Radio.
TNT Radio's Jason Olborn.
Now as 2023 begins, the 2024, can you believe it? It's next year. Presidential election looms ahead. So far, former President Donald Trump has been the only Republican to announce their candidacy for 2024. And the favored Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is widely expected to run. Now other Republicans are making their intentions known. Last month, Donald Trump's ex-national security advisor, John I Am the Walrus Bolton, teased a White House bid and lashed out at Trump over his attack on the Constitution. His attack on the Constitution. He said he would have to join the 2024 presidential race if other Republicans did not step up and condemn the former president trying to get rid of the Constitution to ensure no election fraud reoccurs, despite no evidence the 2020 vote was stolen. Told NBC's Kristen Welker on Meet the Press Now, I think to be a presidential candidate, you cannot simply say, I support the Constitution. You have to say, I would oppose people who would undercut it.
Jason Olborn and Jason Q. Citizen on TNT Radio.
Public school is the instituted agency of socialism throughout every community.
The U.S. government has no authority to have any role in education.
We're going to lose our very republic if we don't stop this indoctrination of children in government schools.
What happened to us in China can happen here. have one kind of education, and then call it equity.
It's about outcomes. It's about trying to force us all to be equal.
I think we're going to have a race civil war in our hands.
We are exposing kids to pornography as early as kindergarten. Parents just don't know.
No, not anymore. Not anymore. Parents need to wake up. They don't have the interests of your child at heart.
Truth and Lies in American Education at salemnow.com.
America can't become a first-rate country again without fixing their third-world elections. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Yeah, welcome back to Sky Dragon Slaying. We've got Gloria Moss, Professor Gloria Moss, an expert in education management. And we've got your new book on in discussion, Gloria, Light Bulb Moments. What are light bulb moments?
Light bulb moments are those sudden moments of perception that come at the end of a long period of thinking. That's the point. Light bulb moments do not happen without a period of critical thinking preceding them. So this is why critical thinking has to be our focus. And notice that the letters that begin those words, CT, are the same as conspiracy theory. We have to put that to one side. No, we're not conspiracy theorists. All of us are critical thinkers who are asking serious questions of everything that's coming our way. And physiologically, the light bulb moments, well, we know about this from research in 2018 that was carried out in Austria. And we found, Dr. Christian Windischberger at the Medical University of Vienna, he used fMRI scans to scan the brains of 29 people in 2018 while they were solving problems. And what they found was that the prefrontal cortex was the part of the brain that was involved. And that's the part of the brain that plans complex cognitive behavior and decision making. So they found that when people finally got to the point of being able to solve the problem, in other words, the light bulb moment, it was the prefrontal cortex that was involved in that process. So we know where the focus is for critical thinking. And do you remember I said that there are multiple obstacles that stand in the way of people being able to think critically? I mean, there are multiple, five psychological obstacles, ranging from informational conformity, social conformity, something called the illusory truth effect, fear and anxiety, and then being exposed to the television. And if I just focus for a second on the effects of fear, which is something that people have been exposed to for the past two or three years, that actually impacts the part of the brain involved in these light bulb moments, the prefrontal cortex. And what a study at Pittsburgh University in 2016 found was that anxiety, whether in animals or humans, could disrupt the brain neurons in the prefrontal cortex. And as we've seen, that is the area of the brain that is critical to making rational decisions. So fear disables critical thinking. So, you know, some of us wonder what on earth has been happening to the mass of people over the last 2 or 3 years, then I think we'd have to say that fear is a big factor because it's shutting down the workings of the prefrontal cortex. I would also talk about personality, which is something else we discuss in the book, that I've identified. It's very exciting, really, that there seem to be particular personality types that are more capable of resisting propaganda than other types of personality. And they're the so-called intuitive type, as measured by the Myers-Briggs type test. But we can talk about that if you want, because I can compare the proportions of intuitive types across the world. with some astonishing findings there. But just quickly going back to fear, this study at Pittsburgh University in 2016 that saw how fear and anxiety can disrupt the brain neurons in the prefrontal cortex, that part of the brain that's critical to making rational decisions. I mean, that was a new finding simply because they identified the part of the brain involved. But as I said earlier, the notion that fear can shut down rational thinking is nothing new. I was interested to see that in the 18th century, the philosopher Edmund Burke, who wrote about the French Revolution, he wrote, and this is interesting, that no passion so effectually robs the mind of all of its powers of acting and reasoning as fear. Isn't that fascinating? And so often it seems to me governments keep their populations in fear. And I'm taking my cue here, if you like, from John Adams, who was one of the founding fathers of America, who wrote in 1776 that fear is the foundation of most governments and renders men stupid and miserable. Well, I thought that was astonishing, but as far back as the 18th century, commentators were aware. So we have to, you know, part of this critical thinking campaign is to make people aware of the elements that can discourage critical thinking, of which fear is one, but also there's elements that can encourage it.
Yeah, I'd like to just throw in there into the mix my own observations. I mean, I'm familiar with the work of Vance Packard. He wrote the book Hidden Persuaders in 1957, a journalist by trade. And he pulled back the veneer, the curtain on the psychological tricks and tactics companies used in their marketing and advertising strategies. And as we know, fear sells, doesn't it? I mean, we look at the daily diet pumped out by TV and films and Netflix and, you know, all these things, Amazon Prime. And what we're seeing is people like to be scared. They like fear. Fear is exciting. It just gets the blood rushing, doesn't it? It really does pique our interest.
Well, absolutely. And what people have found out, not just about fear, but about the effect of film on the brain, it has also been taken advantage of by advertisers. So, for example, it was an American, Thomas Mulholland, back in 1969, I think it was, who discovered that when people watch televisually, I'm going to use the broad phrase, televisually presented information, their brain starts to produce a majority of alpha waves. And what that's doing is putting them into a light hypnotic state, which makes them extremely suggestible. So you can imagine how advertisers, when they learned about Thomas Mulholland's research, they were very quick to want to advertise on TV because people would not be as alert while watching television as they might otherwise. And not just that, but a couple of years later, 1971, Professor Herbert Krugman, listen to this, he showed that when people are watching televisually presented information, people's right hemisphere became twice as active as the left. And we know, I think, that the right hemisphere is the part of the brain that's associated with emotions and not rationality. So again, that would have favored advertisers because, you know, stick people in front of the television and play some nice music, or as you say, fill them with fear, and they'll be extremely susceptible to the advertising. And not just that, but this crossover from the left to the right hemisphere releases, so Krugman's found, a surge of endorphins, which are structurally identical to opium and just as addictive as opium. And so, you know, seeing the same adverts repetitively, people could become quite addicted. I could easily imagine. Isn't it extraordinary? Just the effect of of televisually information, it presented information. And finally, and just to put the nail in the coffin of critical thinking, Jacoby in 2000 found that when people are watching, let's call it TV, the higher brain regions in the neocortex are shut down, with most activity shifting to the lower brain regions, what is often known as the reptilian brain. And that part of the brain is the part of the brain that controls fight or flight response. So here we go back to the fear response. And listen to this. That part of the brain makes it very difficult to differentiate the real from the false. It's really quite scary, isn't it? How information perceived from the television can shut down rational thinking. It would be very interesting, actually, wouldn't it, to do a survey amongst the so-called awake. What proportion of those still watch televisually presented information? I mean, I could imagine a lot of them are watching videos. We would just hope that they're watching with discernment and not suffering these effects.
Well, we want to, I know we've mentioned before in other shows, and I think we mentioned before when you were on our show in September, the problem with the CIA, I mean, they were masters with MK Ultra. Joe Olson, you've spoken on this issue yourself. Let's bring Joe Olson, come in and give your 5 cents on this.
MK Ultra was a mind control that was based on Operation Paperclip Nazis that were brought over, and they had developed the system where you could manipulate people and create multiple personalities and be able to control people through basically fear and trauma. And amazingly enough, they had a thing called Dark Winter, which was an operation put on by the Rockefeller and John Hopkins University in June of 2001. And the next month, NASA had a program called Future Wars 2025. And this was a day-long seminar. The guy had like 100 slides. I watched a two-hour documentary covering some of the presentations that were made by TruthStream Media. Aaron and Melissa Dykes are great independent film producers and researchers. And in that, one of the presentations, he said that in order to have continuation of government, we're going to have to manipulate people through trauma-based mind control. And that's the same thing that they were doing with Operation Monarch and the MK Ultra. And they experimented principally on orphans and prisoners, but also on military people and just absolutely hideous people. Trying to remember the guy's last name was Jolly. And he was the one that was the psychiatrist that interviewed Jack Ruby and actually was the spokesman for Jack Ruby and said, yes, he's, you know, a typical psychopath. He just didn't want Jackie to have to go through the trauma of having a trial for the murder of her husband. And so he had every right to kill Lee Harvey Oswald. And it's just like they manipulated absolutely everything. And as far as the fight or flight, that was the traditional look at it, but now we've realized that there's actually a third response, and that is freeze. So, you know, fight and flight is a typical prey animal response to a threat, but freeze is another but super non-productive response. And getting back to television, the original televisions were a cathode ray tube where you only had several thousand pixels available, and you had a rectifier that shot a single photon starting at one corner of the television and then zigzagging back and forth across the screen. And because of the phosphorus, it would have a little bit of a glow, and so it would glow for a little while in time for the 60 cycle per second to jump back up to the top. So what it appeared to be a continuous signal, if you did a high-speed camera of the signal, you would actually see it's just a one bright dot going across the screen back and forth. And that's what was so hypnotic, is that you're having this pulsing light coming at you. I'm not really sure if the current laser and LED televisions have that same hypnotic effect, but that's okay, because if you spent the majority of your life being hypnotized by the idiot box, then you're definitely going to be susceptible to the continued programming from that particular system. And it's really disappointing how people are so dumbed down at this point. It's absolutely, it's disheartening.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. And Gloria, you must have seen yourself. I mean, like me, we are very much into critical reasoning, critical thinking. And as you referred to, Myers-Briggs is such an important tool in that regard. And as Myers-Briggs tells us, so few people actually possess critical reasoning skills. Do you have the numbers on that? Can you give us a few numbers, roughly what you think that would be?
Well, what's... Just for listeners who may not be familiar, I won't go through it all, but the Myers-Briggs uses Jung's personality types, and it's the most widely used psychometric test in the world, and it measures four pairs of opposites. And if I just focus on one pair of opposites for the moment, and that's the difference between how you receive information, essentially. And the distinction is between the so-called sensing type, who receives information through their five senses. You know, it's what they hear, what they see, what they touch, what they smell. That is the reality for that particular person, the sensing, the so-called sensing type. And very different and opposite from that is the so-called intuitive type. Forget the word, because it doesn't mean intuitive. Joe was talking about the meanings of words. That word intuitive doesn't mean intuitive in this context. The so-called intuitive type is the person who can see beyond their five senses and perceive the world of possibilities. So it's what isn't yet in formation. And the intuitive type can play with data and compare information. So I hope that gives you a sense between these opposing types. And what I did was ask for volunteers from groups of awake people. One group was at, I run a couple of conferences a year. One is called Questioning History, and the other one is called Questioning Science. And we hear some wonderful speakers questioning history and science. And at a Questioning Science event, I asked people if they'd volunteer to complete this, and likewise at other events. And that gave me a total of 85 completed Myers-Briggs types. Okay. And what came out from that was that 93% of the sample, these were awake people, turned out to have this intuitive characteristic. Now, that's almost 100% of the sample. There were very, very few, 7% sensing types. Now, that you might be asking yourself and your listeners, well, how does that compare with the populations of different countries? So what I can do at this point is answer that question. And if I tell you the country, this comes from data from the Myers-Briggs company, and I say it's the most widely used test in the world, so there's a load of this data globally. The country with the lowest proportion of intuitives in the list in the book is the Netherlands. They have 74% of their population is sensing, if you could imagine that. And then if we move up, we get to Italy, which isn't much different from Holland, and France, again, not much different, predominantly sensing population. Maybe that explains the high priority placed on beauty and food in France, a land of sensing people. And Germany isn't much different. 26% of the German population, only 26, are of this intuitive type. People can see beyond the five senses. And if you do the arithmetic, you can see that leaves a massive 74% who are sensing in Germany. UK, that's 63% censing. Very similar in America, slightly higher, 64% censing population in America. Australia is, what's Australia? Oh, they're slightly, that's 66%. No, 65%. 64-65% censing in Australia.
So let's just hold.
You get the picture here.
Let me just take another short break, Glory. We've got to take a short break. We'll be right back after this. Is TNT Radio.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
I will confess I don't know much about the police in the UK. I grew up in New York and I'm a former NYPD PBA Man of the Year, probably the greatest honor I've ever received. But I've always been under the impression that cops are underpaid and there never seems to be enough money to remedy that or to provide police departments and the officers with all that's needed to be as safe and effective as possible. So imagine my surprise when I saw this headline on FoxNews.com. UK police forces spend thousands on rainbow cars and flags supporting LGBT community. So who knew that in the UK, police across the country were so well funded that they could afford to spend $80,000 on this merchandise between 2019 and 2022. Reportedly, the South Wales police force was the biggest spender, forking over roughly $29,000 for rainbow-themed shirts and badges, pens, whistles, flags, water bottles, you name it. What's next? Well, maybe the police won't help you unless you worship the rainbow and prove it. Sounds crazy, huh? So is this whole story. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
It's not a texting the wife seat, a scrolling through your playlist seat, or a taking a call that could be your next job seat.
Hello, Mark's Plumbing.
It's not a replying to the boss's email seat, or a school letting you know about your sick kid seat. It's a driver's seat. If there's someone or something that needs your attention and it can't wait, pull over first, because no one's driving if you're distracted. A message from the Government of South Australia.
Dismiss the talk of an amnesty. We've seen the biggest kill ever in medicine's history. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, welcome back. We're on to Myers-Briggs. We've had a light bulb moment today with Professor Gloria Moss, and we're trying to work out what percentage of our population really possesses critical reasoning and how many of us are just sheep. And Glory, you've been giving us quite a few numbers there, and it's quite startling, isn't it? It's almost intuitive. You kind of know that those who are more sensitive. You gave us a few European countries there. We know the French and the Dutch. We know they do like to express themselves rather than it's a stereotype. I know it's a stereotype, but let's get into that.
Yes.
And I'm very, very intrigued in what you told us in the previous show, because the other end of the spectrum, those are the intuitive types. Those who have the critical reasoning skills, those are the ones who can see through the scam. And give us some of them, please.
Well, yes. Just to recap, in the sample of awake people that took the Myers-Briggs test, that was 85 people. It turned out that 93% of those were intuitives. And you've just seen that that's way, way, way beyond the population norms for European countries, where we saw across European countries, US, Australia, that the average you might find would be sort of mid-20s or 30%, but not much more than that, 37% in the UK. But there are two countries that stand out as different. And, well, I don't know if this comes as a surprise to listeners, but there's Russia, dare I say it, where 55% of the population only are sensing. Do you remember we had a figure of 23% intuitives in Holland? Only 23.
Very low.
In Russia, the proportion of sensing people is much lower. It's only 55%. Sorry, 45%. Let me just say that again. In Russia, 45% of the population are intuitive types, which is vastly more than in the other countries. And Poland tops the list at 46.5% of their, almost half of their population in Poland are intuitive types.
Yeah. And we have a very interesting situation in Ukraine at the moment, don't we, Joe Austin, that might have some bearing on this.
Yeah. You wonder how many people in Ukraine are intuitive at this point, because they certainly are being misled. They're actually nothing but a NATO proxy, which is really sad to see this carnage that's going on. And I don't see any happy solution to it. Got a little anecdote that I like to mention every once in a while. Teacher to student, what is the difference between ignorance and apathy? Student to teacher, I don't know and I don't care. So here's the problem that we have as intuitives, is it capable of us being able to bring these other people to a level of awareness where they'll be able to be contributors and have a more successful life themselves? And so that's what we've tried to do at Principia Scientific, is that we try to expose the vast discrepancy between the root education, as Gloria was mentioning at the very first of the program, that's being force-fed to everybody, that makes no sense and is very hard for the students to digest, causing apathy. And once you have apathy, then it's real easy to have ignorance. One of the guys that's been a pretty famous spokesman on a lot of different fronts was a reporter, Edward R. Murrow, who was famous for saying, you know, "Good night, America." But he did a speech in October 15th, 1958, to the Radio, Television, and Digital News Association. It's a wonderful speech. Videos of it are almost 4 minutes long, so I'm not going to try to quote everything. But what he was talking to them about was the television, and this is his closing two paragraphs. "This instrument can teach, it can illuminate, yes, it can even inspire, but it can only do so to the extent that humans are determined to use it to those ends. Otherwise, it is nothing but wires and lights in a box. There is a great and perhaps decisive battle to be fought against ignorance, intolerance, and indifference. This weapon of television could be very useful." Stonewall Jackson, who's generally believed to know something about weapons, is reported to have said, "When war comes, you must draw the sword and throw away the scabbard. The trouble with television is it is rusting in its scabbard during a battle for survival." Thank you for your patience. I'm sending this to John, and we'll post it at Principia Scientific, because it's a very historic speech on somebody that was really very insightful about where the directions of society were going. He also had a great quote about sheeple, and I know what it was. Oh, I don't know exactly what it was, and I'm not going to misquote it. I paraphrase it, but I will look that quote up and we'll quote it in the next segment.
Yeah, and I want to just chuck in the mix again. You know, you're making very good points, both of you. Like I do my own research as a school teacher of over 30 years. There's a good article by Thomas Malan, Indoctrination in Higher Education. And, he posted this three years ago now, and I picked up on that. He was teaching anthropology, psychology, and sociology in universities in Pittsburgh. And what he found is that the way the education system is being evolving over the past 20 or 30 years is that there's a kind of institutionalized brainwashing effect. And what the methodology is psychological manipulation of students, getting them to a teaching style which emphasizes emotional arousal, which goes back to our original point about the use of fear and the use of the teacher as personally identifying with students and engendering trust, personal loyalty. Again, that plays into the culture of our peers following experts and the idea of the expert rather than critical reasoning. And again, it kind of destroys objectivity, doesn't it, Gloria? You feel the idea of objectivity is being supplanted by subjectivity, the act of being personified, the idea of the personality cult.
Well, yes, and we haven't mentioned the Frankfurt School, have we, in this particular discussion? But they if we have to look at why critical thinking has disappeared, then I think that they they take a fair share of the blame. because they set out to destroy the oppressive structures of Western society. And they focused on dividing people into oppressor and oppressed groups by focusing on age, race, class, gender, sexual orientation, and so on. And that they created the assumption that there's always a marginalized group that needs our sympathy and emotions. And that I think the Frankfurt School played a big part in repressing critical thinking. So what we have to do at this point is be aware of that, be aware of the extent to which the Frankfurt School was behind many fields of study, such as gender theory, queer theory, post-colonial theory, critical race theory, and all the other theories. And we really need to put the clock back. They were around in the 1930s. We need to put the clock back and restore critical thinking. And yes, for the sensing type, for whom the intuitive way of thinking doesn't come natural, then we've all been teachers at one point, then we need to be aware of that and try and deliver information in a way that will appeal to people's senses. That's, I think, the way to do that. What were you going to say, John?
Yeah, I just want to throw into them what you're adding there. The you're talking about the Frankfurt School, and that, as you say, emerged during the Weimar Republic in Germany in the late 1920s, early 1930s, and again that ties in very neatly with the idea of I feel it's like appeal to authority, constant appeal to authority, service to a leader, keeping in lockstep, don't question everything. Again, serving others and not the individual. And I personally feel, and I think Joe Ellison shares my point on this, the idea of the individual liberty is being suppressed, isn't it? More than anything, we feel that individuality is being questioned. It's no longer a virtue to be an individual. It's more important, as you say, to belong to a group. And we identify with groups. And my own personal journey is one where I've gone from being very much a typical school teacher, very much following the ideas of the left, especially in the UK. I mean, most school teachers in the left are, quite openly left wing. I mean, school teachers vote Labour over here, as you know, Gloria. It's a profession where if you hold left wing views, you're very welcome. And unfortunately, there are very few people who hold views on the right that get any look in at all. And one of the guys I admire in Canada is Professor Jordan Peterson, because he holds very conservative views, and somebody who's been vilified so much. To his credit, he stood firm and he's made a wonderful career out of it. And he's now an icon. And I'm sure we need more like that and not fewer. And Joe Olson, do you have anything to add on that one?
Oh, yes. I found 10 quotes from Edward R. Murrow. I won't repeat all of them, but the one I was trying to remember was, "A nation of sheep will beget a government of wolves." And here's two more that really apply to our current dilemma. "We cannot defend freedom abroad by deserting it at home." And then another one is, "No one can terrorize a whole nation unless we are all his accomplices." So, basically what we're still trying to do is to elevate humanity to the point where there's more intuitives around and we can help solve problems instead of going with the flow and being exterminated, because that's apparently where they've got us headed at this particular point.
Yeah, and I don't know whether you know of this character, but there is a character that's been on the YouTube, on British news quite a lot, YouTube influencer, Andrew Tate. Do you know the name Andrew Tate?
He's a Romanian martial arts fighter, isn't he?
No, nearly right. He's actually Anglo-American. He lives in Romania.
Oh, okay.
And was arrested. And he has come to the fore in the past year. I've been following his case very interestingly. He's actually advocating for men's rights and anti-woke and very much speaking out for the demise of the masculine form in education. as we, I tend to agree, and maybe Gloria, you may or not agree with me on this one, but I think that we've seen boys being more feminized. I think that the idea of the masculine thing has been toned down a bit. Would you like to comment on that?
Well, yes, I think, well, we know that white working class boys do least well in the school system in Britain. And some people say the system is favours the female style of learning, you know, sitting down, concentrating, doing written exams.
I don't mean to interrupt you. We're going to actually, I mean, I love this conversation. Mm-hmm. I love the idea of getting your viewpoint on this. What we'll do, Gloria, we'll come back, if it's all okay with you, after the news. We're coming up to a news break now. This is Sky Dragon Slaying.